G'day, I'm Sue Gilby from Adelaide Chronicles. I asked a select group of people to imagine what unlearnings needed to happen to ensure a regenerative future that respected the first people. I got some fabulous answers, so listen up.
Individuals talking about a recent visit to the mall. They're both Aboriginal people. And basically this fellow goes, he says, I don't know what it is, but every time I go down the mall, the Aboriginal people tell me I'm not Aboriginal, and the non-Aboriginal people tell me I'm Aboriginal, but yet I've got two parents who are white, and I have gone to school, and I've learnt, and I've done all these things. And so what is it? And his mate's trying to tell you, he said, mate, you're Aboriginal, you're black, like, your colour of your skin is what's is telling people who you are. And but he said, but they call me names like Coon and Jackie and all this sort of stuff. And then, you know, the Aboriginal people start talking in language and I don't know what they're saying to me and all this sort of stuff. Basically, what I then ask, I pose a question, I say, so what's happened here? And so people then, they'll go, oh, he's been taken into a non-Aboriginal family. He's, you know, he's been assimilated, and so he's gone to school, he's been educated, he's been raised in a world that says this is how you live and this is how you act, and yet what has he always been judged by? The colour of his skin. Because people don't know his education, people don't know where he's come from, don't know his story, his situation, and so therefore the question is, can we be assimilated? The answer is no. Because it's always going to be something that's going to judge you and it in a sense that separates you. And so therefore we should explore the fact that individuality and differences should be a great thing. It shouldn't be about we should all be the same. And that's the problem that we have in this society, that we want everybody to be the same. It's like we do. We want all Aboriginal people to live in the city.
Mm.
But we know that as soon as you put Aboriginal people in the city, what actually happens? Oh, I don't want them living next door to me because they have 20 fellas living in their house and they drink or they play up and they do that. Well, you know, that's because their cultural background is how they live and explore. And if you're saying you're open and sensitive to different cultural groups, well, then that's what they've got to live somewhere. So if you don't want them living in the cities, let's help them live in the areas that they come from. Because the thing is, what we forget is you and I choose to some degree where we want to live, don't we?
Absolutely.
And sometimes that is by our finances, sometimes that's by our linkages and our connections. So why should we not want those Aboriginal people that have lived and connected with their homelands in remote regional areas, allow them to live there? Because I remember there was just after the Closing the Gap report came out, where you might have remembered this famous saying that came out of Tony Abbott at the time when he was the Prime Minister, and he was saying about how they haven't reached all the targets in Closing the Gap. But when he went on commercial radio, he said, it's not up to the taxpayers to educate them and teach them all this sort of stuff. If they want to choose in the places where there's no schooling and no that, well, that's their fault for not getting educated or having poor health. And so therefore, it's about what they call it. He had a catchphrase which was about choices, something choices. It was something, the word choices was the word. But I remember this radio host said, well, surely we should be celebrating and encouraging people to live in areas outside the city so that we can get more people out of the city, so that we're using those spaces and stuff like that where you know, economic development and all those sorts of things can be encouraged and promoted. And so, you know, when we talk cultural business a lot of the times, we always put this negative slant against any Aboriginal issues, like they're costing you personally, or their problems are their problems and they're impacting on us, and yet we forget all those stories that really, in a sense, tells us that Aboriginal people have been painted in ways that sometimes is completely opposite to the people they are. I mean, in my opinion, Aboriginal people largely are passive people. And why do I say that? Well, one, do you see them, a lot of other nations, going to war with the people that they lost their land to? No. Yeah, they might verbally go to war, but they don't physically go to war. And so to me, that's a passive approach. And when you even see some of those stories around colonization, that, you know, Aboriginal people danced and all this. And as my father says, we've been welcoming people for thousands of years. We never told anybody to go home. Generally, people went home. You know, and there's a Aboriginal song which only Alice Lowitcher Rigney used to sing, which was really that song, which was, it was the Nina Marnie song, which was, you know, Nina Marnie, Marnie I, wanted inna, Wadliana, Wadliana, which said, how are you, how are you? I'm going good, where you going, where you going? I'm going home. And, you know, as we know, as a nation, we've had the Dutch, the English, the French, the Chinese,
Italians,
Greece, Italians, yeah, and Germans,
yeah,
well, they've all come to our nation, and so we are a very cultural, multicultural nation, particularly these days. But we've always been embracing. But even when I look at some of those, you know, early when South Australia, when I particularly look, here's the king of the day, King William, who wrote in his letters patent, which is our founding documents, which we hide in a wooden box in the state records department, which says he wanted the Aboriginal people to own and occupy the land that they stood upon. And therefore, he wanted them to have this relationship with the land. Then you look at the flag from 1876 to 1904. Who did it have in there? A person from Britannia, an Aboriginal man sitting on a rock throne being greeted by the person representing the English being from Britannia. Yeah, we got rid of that flag. But then when you look at my great-great-great-grandmother Kanata, who was one of those last full-blooded Kaurna people who went to the native school, learnt to read and write English, then ended up marrying a non-Aboriginal man. So therefore getting that connection of that building with non-Aboriginal people, but also was a way of getting her own country back by, because they gave them land at that particular time when you married a non-Aboriginal person. Sadly, when she died, she lost that land, and her children didn't benefit by that, which was really, in a sense, wrong and sad at the same time. And so we've got all these indications of, particularly in South Australia, where Aboriginal people have been a part of this country and influential, sadly, still, in some ways, hasn't shifted people's beliefs and thoughts on a holistic and expanding way, only on an individual way. Like when you look at David Unipin, the Aboriginal Da Vinci, sure, it's on the $50 note, but people wouldn't know who he really was.
No, what he did.
Sir Doug Nicholls, who was a governor. He got sick, and so he only had a short period of time. But still, people would have known he was an Aboriginal man. And you know, my Nana Glad Elphick, who was a pioneer for Aboriginal women particularly, and then also as a community as a whole, who was recently recognised in the little book of women saints.
Yeah, I saw that.
And I think she's the only Australian person in there, as well as the only Aboriginal person in there. And she was the saint of community. And fantastic for us as a family to be connected to that. But it shows you that our people were always working to be equals, and we did that in not just voice but our action. The fact that we went to war, and many of our people were left behind because of the white Australia policy, not because they died, because they weren't allowed to return. I remember Dad telling me a story that someone's here because he joined the Merchant Navy and he didn't have a passport, and he remembers that because of his, you know, Aboriginal background, that they, you know, possibly might not have got back, but his colleagues or helped him with that.
A whole lot of people didn't get back
in. Oh, no, they were left. Yeah, they were left, particularly in the Boer War. They were left. Yeah, they were left. Yeah, and they had enough families.
Yeah.
Well, even when you look recently, which I heard about, and I'm sure you have, about blackbirding. You heard of blackbirding. How in Queensland, particularly, they took these people from the Pacific Islands, made them work the sugarcane fields, but when they sent them back home, I don't know if they did it deliberately or accidentally, they took the Aboriginal people and put them back to Vanuatu, where they couldn't return back to their homelands and end up having to make their own families and connections to Vanuatu. And recently, actually this year, I got to meet some of those I met some of the Aboriginal people from Vanuatu who were their descendants.
Children,
And their descendants are from, you know, obviously
and
Queensland.
Did the children feel a connection to here?
Oh, yeah, they did. And they were fascinated because for them, as much as, you know, Pacific Islands are rich in their culture, for them to see those things like, you know, the Aboriginal flag or the boomerang and elements that were culturally significant to our people really sent a beautiful relationship with them because it gave them that sense of connection to their descendants, you know, their forefathers who came from this country.
So can they get dual citizenship?
No, and that's what they're fighting
they
for.
They still can't.
No.
Not in this day and age.
No,
they still can't.
No, they're fighting to get that.
That's so wrong.
It is wrong. Even though they did recently, after the national apology, they did get an apology that they recognised that Aboriginal people were taken from Queensland and sent to Vanuatu and other Pacific Islands. And so they've got an apology, but they didn't get the ability to get citizenship back to Australia. And
that's
so they still. And so that's why I went along to this event, and that's why they worked hard to get them to come to Australia, because what they wanted to do as a part of that is actually take them to the heads to be to help them by having people actually in their face, not a piece of paper, having human beings in their face to say that, well, these are the people that come from this nation. They have a right to be connected, reconnected back to their nation and their homelands. So they were hoping so, but I haven't heard if that happened or not. So hopefully they did because, yeah, it's an interesting story, but more importantly, a sad story that for not only the Pacific Islanders, but, you know, when you talk about our nation, specifically our nation. And really, we're a funny nation, really, I think, Australians, aren't we? We love multiculturalism. We love embracing those cultural differences. We love supporting and fighting for other nations and human rights and in some ways human differences, as we recently saw with our LGBTQ community. And we've seen, you know, I know growing up, we've seen all those horrific things that happened, like, you know, Hiroshima and the Holocaust and then, you know, Agent Orange during the Vietnam War and all these sorts of things. And we've been impacted by that. And particularly when you look at those groups that were impacted, where it largely they sit in our communities and are embraced to a large degree. And yet Australia doesn't tell those horrific stories.
No.
That we massacred people, that disease killed our people, that, you know, removing them was a deliberate act. You know, when you had words like not just half-caste, quarter-caste and those, we had quadroons and octoroons, which tells you we deliberately had these things. And then when you read, you know, I remember seeing some from missions and stuff where they had their quest for supplies and that, and then seeing that they ordered arsenic and all this to put in the food of the Aboriginal people and all that sort of stuff. And it's sad. I mean, you know, like recently, you know, I'm saddened by the fact that the community centre that Dad started some 30 years ago, Kuriella Childcare Centre, which also supports youth, women's groups, men's groups, and obviously this child centre, is owned by, it was previously an old orphanage, which some of our children went to, but is owned by the Catholics, the nuns, and they've just recently been told they're going to sell it.
Oh, really?
And so now they have no place. And they said, we'll help you look for a childcare centre, but as far as your other programs, your youth and men's and women's business, we're not going to help you with that. And you just think, like, why wouldn't you be giving them this actual land? I mean, one, you don't obviously clearly have a purpose for it anymore, but you still own it, and you've really capitalised on the backbone of not just only Aboriginal people, but really children who have been put in orphanages. How about if you really want to show reconciliation, you want to truly show that your community is spirited, give the land back. Give the land to the Aboriginal people that have been servicing that community for 30 years. Let them keep it. But you're selling it. So you're making a profit, really, off the back end of what was clearly, sadly, trauma and sadness from other people.
Bought it in the first place.
Well, no, they wouldn't have bought it. It would have been gifted to them.
It would have been gifted.
And when you consider, really, the monies would have been gifted as well, because they would have been supported by certainly the government, but also the community themselves, because people that go to churches are community people. So, you know, that's what I keep saying to them, that you should be giving that to us, but people, oh, no, they can't give it to you. Well, yeah, you can. That's what you do. Mm. That's what happened in Ernabella. You know, that was, you know, church mission area, and and they ended up letting them, you know, obviously missions were then out of favour, but so it was easy to give it back to them. I suppose, you know, as a young person, you know, growing up, I was largely connected with my Narunga heritage, and, you know, I used to go to the Yorke Peninsula a fair bit and see mum's family, and growing up and understanding the impacts of the mission there, and how people were living and supporting each other. And sadly, when you get older, you start doing your own thing. You know, I played sports, and obviously mum and dad were very much on going to school and doing those things. And so I find myself only going back to the Narunga community in funerals these days, not on family fun.
Plenty of them too.
Yeah, sadly it is, you know, because our people, you know, get old. And so now I find myself, because of that age of responsibility, really largely than anything, that, you know, I'm watching those great people like Nana Glad Elphick and Dad and Auntie Alice and Auntie Veronica and Auntie Jose and Lowitcher and these sorts of people who have done great things in the community. And now, you know, if you want to say you're culturally connected and minded, then it means, and particularly if you want to say that saying of oldest living continuous culture, well, you only can do that if you're practicing it, and ways to practice that is that, you know, it still is culture, even though you can look at it in modern terms, which is you all have skills, talents or roles, and to help support your community, you know. Sure, directly putting bread and butter on the tables of every community member, but when you're working in an organisation or you're advocating for people, that's what you're doing. And
when you're raising awareness too,
yeah,
that's exactly what you're doing.
Yeah, it is. And so you're trying to do it with Western world tools rather than directly those cultural tools. And so, you know, Dad still continues to do that. And so I find myself now not just doing, you know, as much as I do a lot of Welcome to Country, and I have the opportunity to speak to children in schools and even adults about some of those cultural past histories and the impacts of trauma and things like that. But, you know, I sit on a number of committees and groups, and I try to support our people through that, but also sometimes I try to loudly speak for the wider community on those cultural needs and the issues that, as we see, still continue. They don't, you know, and as I've, through different voices, you know, it just comes in different waves or different forms, as we say, you know, when you look at the thing like the intervention that's still currently going on, and you just think, like, what's that all about? You know, here it was, well, it was a national emergency on child pedophilia, but hang on a minute, you've been now going since 2007, so it's now 2018, and how can it still be going when really, oh no, it was 2002, I think it was, wasn't it?
2007 it was introduced, but
yeah, came. Sorry, two, yeah. And yet it wasn't really meant to be a thing about children, but yet no one's been prosecuted over child pedophilia cases. And what they've done now is change the name, it's Stronger Futures, and it's going to 2022. And they've had to suspend the Racial Discrimination Act, which is something that impacts us all. Technically speaking, we could go around and say racial comments towards people when really we can't be charged with it because there's no such thing as racial discrimination.
If it can be suspended just like that.
Yeah, if it can be suspended. And who is it targeting?
One emergency.
Yeah, I know. And it's only one specific group. When you saw army, police, government people, and the monies they used were royalties from mining. I mean, there's some great movies out, one being the movie Utopia,
yeah.
And the other one that I show a lot, which is Our Generation, which really talks specifically about the intervention from the Aboriginal person community's perspective, which is really demonstrates the impacts.
It reinforces that negative stereotype, because you're taking away people's any form of self-directed power by putting them on that card. It's what it does to people is just awful.
Well, it is. I mean, somebody told me a story how here's this gentleman who's worked, an Aboriginal man, worked all his life, actually went to war, fought for his country. So he's on a veteran's pension now. And so he's always been an upstanding community member and contributor to his community, whether it be Aboriginal community or non-Aboriginal community. And yet he's been treated as if he has no understanding on how to manage his affairs, because he's got to have a basic card, and that because it was a full blanket approach. It wasn't an individual approach, it was a full blanket approach. And so he was affected. And what they did was also push a lot of people to the South Australian communities, because they wanted to get away from the basic cards and this impact of not being able to dictate your own terms. And it was really wrong for that to happen. But what do you do? Because sadly, we get it wrong. You know, when we talk about democracy, people tend to think, well, it's about the group that gets the most people get the most say. And that's true.
Mm.
But it's not about getting the most say for the things that you want. What it's saying is you have now the opportunity to have the most say, which means you're therefore meant to look after the minority groups that don't have the say. It's not about saying I ignore the minority groups and the minority groups just have to follow the majority groups. That's not what it's about. But we confuse it. We think that when you're the majority group, well, it's about what the majority wants. Well, it's not. It's about saying, how do we still make it inclusive for the minority groups?
And inclusion's the key word.
It is. And it really saddens me, and because, you know, when you look at Aboriginal culture, that's what we were. You know, when Dad talks about this, you know, the word for the brain, or mukka mukka being two halves, or the reciprocity, which is about mutual benefit, and about this two-ness, about the fact that it was about, you know, giving and taking, and it was about sharing and understanding. And that's why we had totems, that you looked after the animals and the plants and the special areas, waterways and all these sort of things, because it said that if you looked after the land, it looked after you. But it also meant that you didn't take everything. It left something for somebody else. And if they left something for somebody else, that means there was things always being left and for everybody.
And you look after the next generation.
Well, you do. And we sort of lost this in society, where we've become, as I call it, bird syndrome, where we raise people, we give them life, we educate them, and then we push them out of the nest and say, nah, you're on your own now. And if you fly, fantastic. If you don't, bad luck. Whereas when you look at community, it wasn't about that. It was about this, and you still see it largely in European families and a lot of Asian families, where they see that, you know, mum, dad, auntie, uncle, or grandparents and grandchildren, and all those sorts of things still connect, live in, and create communities. I mean, somebody asked me one time, you know, because sadly, as you mentioned before, you know, our people get these negative taunts, and sadly, media paint that, because when they talk about Aboriginal people that might get in trouble, they say Aboriginal people. They don't just go, this man or woman got in trouble. No, it's an Aboriginal person, which then all the media says, oh, we've got to look out for Aboriginal people. They're, you know, bad people. And it's not right. But the thing is, you know, when we were getting some of our people that were camping in the West Parklands and South Parklands, and sure, they were causing some trouble. And they asked, well, what's the solutions? I said, well, one of the solutions would be, don't put all the services in a one-stop shop. You've got all the services they need, which is like the detox centres, the food centres, the accommodation centres, social centres. You've put them all in one stop. Well, you've invited them to come to the city. So therefore, that's clever.
Yeah.
Now you tell them you don't want them there, but they need those services. Yeah. So the best thing is, we should be putting those services in places that are spread. Why? Because then they're going to go to those services because they need those services, not because they're there. And so, therefore, we've got to be encouraging people this aspect of it all. And then I sat there in this forum group where they were talking about it, And I said, you know, we as, particularly as Aboriginal leaders that are in this forum group, we got to be the educators to say, it's, how can we help you? Like we've done, we've had to, in a sense, accept some of the Western world things, but we haven't lost our cultural values. So therefore, how do we educate and teach them to have those benefits as well? It shouldn't be about saying, oh, no, we've got to keep them and defend for them and advocate. No, we've got to have all these services and we've got to help them. And really, because what we're saying is we want them to be poor, suffering people, whereas we should be doing ourselves out of jobs. So we don't have Aboriginal people having to rely on these services.
You're listening to Adelaide Chronicles.